You're listening to a Roddenberry podcast.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast, episode 535, Counterpoint.
Welcome into another episode of Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast. I'm John Champion.
And I'm Adam Pranica, sitting in for Norman Lau. Each week on Mission Log, it's a careful, dangerous game. Sizing up an episode of Star Trek, peeling back the layers, and seeing who's telling the truth in the end.
This week, Counterpoint, the one where Janeway falls for the guy from the wrong side of the tracks. But don't worry about her. She's got them all figured out. Adam, welcome to Mission Log. I feel like this has been such a long time coming. We are blessed with some incredible guest co-hosts to join us while Norman takes some personal time off. And you, of course, maybe need no introduction to our audience, but why don't you tell folks about the show that you do?
I am one of the hosts of Greatest Generation and Greatest Trek, along with Benjamin R. Harrison. And Greatest Generation is a show about catalog Star Trek, the older Star Trek, and Greatest Trek is about all the new Star Trek series that are coming out on the streaming services. And we've been doing those shows for 8 years. We've got hundreds of episodes, and it's been a blast. It's changed our lives. Like, we both used to be professional video producers who dabbled in podcasting as a hobby. And this hobby just kind of elbowed its way into our lives, and we became professional podcasters, like 7.5 years ago. It happened really fast once we started.
It's so weird because we've had this conversation before privately where it's like if you said to your 12-year-old self, like, yeah, there's a thing in the future where you can make a living talking about Star Trek. it doesn't make any sense, and yet here we are.
I was a consumer of podcasts a long time before I ever guested on one or thought about making one. I thought the format was so fun. I liked the idea of like a subscription radio show sort of idea. And just the idea that I could turn a fun conversation with a friend into a career, I never would have believed that 10 years ago. But I'm so glad it's happened. It's made a great life.
And here we are, and I love this kind of thing where we get to cross-pollinate a bit and welcome different people into our various shows. And
we're gonna destroy the internet. Star Trek internet.
I think there's something very dangerous about this.
The show art for this is gonna be like me popping a cork over my back of champagne,
right?
Like.
Exactly. I cannot wait for that. That bulbous, never mind. I can't wait to see that. But no, I'm absolutely thrilled that you're here. And this is an interesting time for us to kind of play with the format of Mission Log and stretch it out a little bit. And first of all, I want you to tell people where they can find you. And then I'm going to ask you to tell people where they can find us.
I don't really have a huge social media presence, but my show does.
Excellent.
And the show's on Twitter and Facebook, and we have a Discord and all those things. At Greatest Trek is a handle you could use. Hashtag Greatest Gen is a handle you'll see all the time. Our Discord is drunkshimoda.com. Thousands of people are over there having laughs about not just what we do on our show, but like watching the shows themselves and coming up with great jokes and memes and stuff. I try to drop into that place every couple of weeks. It's always a blast. One thing about our audience is that they've created all the spaces on social media for the show. Ben and I haven't made any of them, and that's by design.
Yeah.
Like, I like that our folks are out there talking about the things that are important to them and making friends and like getting married to each other and stuff. That's such a wild quality to our audience. Like,
right.
Things like that have happened. We've had proposals at live shows.
Wow.
Yeah. So our community is really fun and funny and welcoming. So yeah. Search for Greatest Gen or Greatest Trek wherever there is social media to be had.
Fantastic.
And,
join
a group.
I love that a place like Discord kind of takes a life of its own. That's just one of my favorite things. And I tell you, and if people who are listening to this don't actually know where to find us, which I hope they would, what should they do?
Mission Log is a conversation about Star Trek, and you can find the show at Mission Log at Roddenberry.com and on X and Facebook at Mission Log Pod. And while you're at it, a review and rating at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform makes a big difference to the podcasts you love, podcasts like Mission Log and Greatest Gen. Always remember, your comments could be used on Mission Log or Engage on the Roddenberry YouTube channel. The Roddenberry Industrial Complex will not be denied.
No.
They will take your comments
exactly.
and contributions for their own.
We will not be denied here or on any other platform.
And now here's John with this week's trivia.
Why, thank you, Adam. All right, let's get into Counterpoint. We have a story credited to Michael Taylor, and we've only had a handful of shows from Michael, but there are some real powerhouses in there. How about DS9 The Visitor and In the Pale Moonlight, for starters? He has many more credits on Voyager, and this one, among his own personal favorites, is near the beginning of his time on this series. He later followed Ron Moore for the creation of the rebooted Battlestar Galactica. One thing about this episode, though, like so many, its start was something very different. The original pitch came from Gregory Norris and Laura Van Vliet. They had a story about Seven of Nine helping refugees who had stowed away on Voyager. From there, the idea got communicated to Nick Sagan, and he repitched it to Brannon Braga. By then, the idea came together to give Janeway a romantic subplot and let her take the lead. This was directed by Les Landau, and we can't forget Les is one of the Trek production crew back at the very beginning of TNG when he was the first assistant director of Encounter at Farpoint. He broke through to director when he took over the ill-fated Code of Honor. But then he hit. Yeah, I know. Yeah, nobody wants that. But you know what? But he did. He took the assignment. So, yeah. And then he hit his stride, though, in season two, and he carried on to DS9 and later on to Enterprise. On Voyager, we most recently discussed his work with Drone, and he's got one more episode with this series before we catch up with him again on Enterprise. Let's meet our guest stars. You may be able to tell kind of right away that they definitely blew the budget on the guest star lineup for this one, because it's essentially a bottle show. You know, you get all the action on board Voyager, so you save a little money that way instead of spending it on new sets. Well, let's see. We get to welcome back Alexander Enberg as Vorik. Also welcome back to veteran Star Trek guest star Randy Oglesby, who plays Kier in this outing. We've mentioned him before in the TNG episode Loud as a Whisper, where he first appeared as part of Riva's chorus. And then there was his time on DS9 playing Twin Miradorn in Vortex, and then later as the seriously disturbed Silurian Prynne in The Darkness and the Light. We'll see Randy one more time in an appearance on Enterprise.
We have, you know, we called the chorus in Loud as a Whisper on our show the Dick Valets.
Wait, what did you call them?
On our show, we called them the Dick Valets. If that gives a Mission Log audience member any sort of glimpse into... how irreverent we are
it's just
about the materials we cover.
It might be a counterpoint to the way that we covered it back in the day.
Two parts of a balanced breakfast, I think.
Exactly.
Our shows.
You need both sides. Let's see here. We have a very brief encounter with Torat, played by Randy Lowell. Randy got his start in the early 80s and easily jumped from TV guest roles to feature films. In fact, he shows up in National Lampoon's Vacation, Real Genius, The Limey, and Contagion, to name just a very few. Now, his name may not jump out at you all the time, but he was sometimes credited as Randall Dreyfus. Maybe a little more on that later. Let's see here. Of our D'Vor, there's Prax, played by J. Patrick McCormick, and we've mentioned him before when he appeared as Admiral Bennett in the DS9 episode Dr. Bashir, I Presume, and we saw him on the big screen as a Romulan commander in Star Trek Nemesis. And finally, there's Kashyyyk, played by Mark Haralick. Texas-born Mark, it may not surprise you to learn, has a long background in live theater, not just as an actor, but also as a playwright. His on-screen credits go back to the early 80s, and he has made numerous genre appearances from Angel to Jurassic Park 3, and he continues to be a very busy actor and has recently appeared on Perry Mason, Presumed Innocent, and recurring on The Morning Show.
Were you ever able to find out if he was fronting a Chris Isaak tribute band?
Did he had that kind of vibe, right?
Yeah. Sure did. Yeah. A pretty good looking gentleman.
Not surprised by that at all. And look, it may not surprise you also to learn that Mark has played Judas no fewer than 3 times on stage in different productions. So keep that.
What a bit of typecasting.
Right? Not to give away anything here, but just keep that in mind while we get to the recap.
Amazing.
Isn't that awesome?
Welcome to the Delta Quadrant. Pop your hood. We'll check for oil leaks, loose screws, and telepaths. We'll check your wiper fluid too.
Prologue. Voyager is hailed by a D'Vor vessel, and clearly not for the first time. Time for some sort of routine inspection by traversing their space, and the crew dutifully prepare. Somewhere, a transporter is activated, and 7 of 9 reports that the cargo bay is clear, just as D'Vor guards materialize on Voyager. Their chief inspector, Kashyyyk, sits in Janeway's ready room, smugly attempting to charm her with a cup of replicated coffee and the invitation to make herself at home. Act 1. The D'Vor guards ransack and intimidate and generally make a nuisance of themselves all over Voyager and its crew, all to the strains of Mahler's First Symphony, which Kashyyyk plays over the PA. He's trying to reach Janeway on some sort of personal level, all while his goons look for something. Specifically, Voyager would be in violation of D'Vor law by having any telepaths on board. The D'Vor have a serious issue about trust, and telepaths make that difficult. While Voyager had 2 Vulcans, Tuvok and Vorik, and 2 Betazoids, Jurat and Suter, all telepaths, but Janeway says they're all dead. The first 3 in a shuttle accident, and the last one, well, that's complicated. Even when Kashyyyk's chief goon, Prax, walks in and reports that they've found nothing but should be impounding Voyager on a technicality for diverting from their course, Kashyyyk is uninterested and lets them go. This time. As soon as they're in the clear, Janeway gives the order to the transporter team to go into action. It's tough going at first, but with a bit of effort, Tuvok, Vorik, Jurat, and more than a few telepathic refugees, including children, are freed from the pattern buffer back into the cargo bay. Act 2. So Voyager has been up to this cat-and-mouse game with the D'Vor for a while. The refugee telepaths, along with our own, have been hiding in the transporter buffer every time there's an inspection. The plan is to meet up with a ship hiding in a Mutara-class nebula to take them to safety via a wormhole. But there's a new wrinkle. All that time in the buffer is causing cellular degradation. Much more of this could be fatal. Before long, a D'Vor vessel approaches, but this time it's just a shuttle, and there's only one person aboard. It's Kashyyyk, and he says he's seeking asylum. Naturally, Janeway is skeptical, but Kashyyyk drops a bomb. He knows about the telepathic refugees, he knows about the transporter, and he knows about the wormhole. They're walking into a trap if they go toward the nebula, but he can save them if they get him out of D'Vor space with them. Act 3. Kashyyyk makes himself useful right away. He helps Janeway, 7, and Tuvok spot hidden D'Vor ships in the nebula thanks to some intel about their refractive shielding. He also tells them that the rendezvous coordinates for the telepaths was forged, so they'll need to find the wormhole on their own. After conferring with her security team, Janeway orders that a close eye be kept on Kashyyyk, but they'll accept his offer to help. For now. One of the refugees, Kier, suggests that they should get some information about the wormhole from a scientist called Torat, whose help is likely negotiable for the rare fuel he needs for his ship. Meanwhile, Janeway discusses the situation with Kashyyyk. She doesn't trust him, but she's willing to take him along for the ride, assuming he'll help and keeping him under guard. 2 days later, Torad is located, and he's not exactly interested in helping, so Voyager kind of imposes itself. Torad is beamed aboard and tempted with quantities of mercurium isochromate for his ship, but he still plays dumb about the wormhole. That is until Kashyyyk steps in and impugns the quality of his scientific knowledge. The reverse psychology works, and with Torad's ego sufficiently bruised, he hands over data on the wormhole's last 4 locations. It'll be up to them to figure out the next appearance. Cut to the mess hall, where late at night, Janeway and Kashyyyk rack their brains trying to come up with a pattern, any clue where the wormhole might appear again. They listen to classical music, and Janeway is inspired. Just as the music has a counterpoint, perhaps the wormhole has a counterpoint in subspace. That'll take some serious computer power to calculate, so while the rainbow beach ball spins all over their screen, Janeway and Kashyyyk admire the astronomical phenomenon outside the window. Like Earth's own northern lights, this beautiful light show puts them both in a reflective mood about home. Kashyyyk has been studying up on Starfleet. He even asks about the Prime Directive and the way Janeway has broken it, especially now by rescuing the telepaths. She says she goes with her gut and sorts it out later. And then she turns the question of conscience around on him. Why did he leave the D'Vor Imperium? Kashyyyk tells a somber story about pulling a telepathic child out of hiding, and when he did, she thanked him, even though his next action was to order her and the rest of them to a relocation center where, presumably, they would die. He's been living with the guilt for months. His story ends as the computer chimes with the result of its calculation. The next wormhole has been predicted, 3 days away in the Tahara system. It's late now, though, and they can work on the route in the morning. What Kashyyyk shares in the meantime is tactical data about a sensor array between Voyager and their destination. It'll pick up anything at high velocity and outputting power, and Janeway thinks they might be able to fool it by drifting in. There are many details to work out in the morning, but for now, Kashyyyk is in a celebratory mood and invites the captain in for a nightcap. She reminds him that the replicator in his quarters is offline, a mere safety precaution. They bid each other goodnight, and Janeway catches a look from the security officer outside, who she tells to stand as you were. Act 4. The sensor array is doing what it does, and Voyager tries to glide on through, but there's a problem. The first pass works, but then there's a problem with the antimatter stream getting jostled, and that means on the next pass, Voyager gets detected. An alert goes out to the D'Vor, so the race is on to get to the wormhole as fast as possible. Then Kashyyyk makes a bold proposal. He'll return to the D'Vor warships and take command of the inspection. That way he can thwart their efforts and give cover to the telepaths while they make their way to the wormhole. Janeway is both reluctant and concerned. Offering up safe passage on Voyager again if he should find the opportunity to join them, when Kashyyyk is on his way, Janeway sees him to the shuttle, and the two share their goodbyes. She tells him that Voyager will wait near the wormhole as long as they can for him to come back. They kiss, and then they kiss again, like really kiss, and Janeway watches as he flies away in his shuttle. Act 5. Right on time, the D'Vor warships appear, and the same aggressively routine inspection begins. Kashyyyk takes his place in Janeway's ready room, but as soon as the others are gone, they confide in each other. She tells him the refugees are in transporter suspension and that they've discovered the location of the wormhole. They can light it up with a photon torpedo and pass right through. As soon as she spills the beans, Kashyyyk calls Prax back into the room and tells him to round up the telepaths. Janeway shows her disappointment, but commends Kashyyyk on an excellent performance. What about that child? That sad story he told. All true, except he had no regrets about sending that little girl away. Now he forces Janeway to the bridge to enact her plan. First, to fire a torpedo at the neutrino emissions they spotted, but follow it with a second torpedo that will seal off the wormhole forever. He fires, and nothing. The neutrinos were just some antimatter residue. The jig is up. Meanwhile, the rest of the inspection team beamed in the biosigns from the transporter buffer, and they were merely cargo containers filled with vegetables. Some 20 million kilometers away, the telepaths were secreted away in two of Voyager's shuttles, hidden from view by the D'Vorah's own refractive shielding. It's too late to catch them as they safely pass through the wormhole and the entrance collapses behind them. Prax assumes he is to arrest Janeway and then impound Voyager, but Kashyyyk wants to wipe the whole embarrassing situation from memory and orders his team to return to their ships. Privately, Kashyyyk shares his admiration for Janeway's strategy, and she says that the offer to take him with them would still stand if he had kept his part of the bargain. Kashyyyk leaves the bridge, with Janeway back in command, listening to Mahler as the D'Vorah ships depart and Voyager resumes course. The end.
So, John, what are you going to do with my audio of the episode recap that I recorded?
It was really good. In fact, it was so good. I think that we need to make it a super special secret download for our top tier Patreon. Like it's so golden that we should only share it with that tiny portion of the audience who are worthy. We're truly worthy.
I'm glad you think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't we get to some observations
I
can also participate in? What do you say?
I'd like, hey, welcome back to the show. That'd be really nice.
You've forgotten who I am, I'm Adam Pranica from Greatest Generation and Greatest
Trek.
It has been a while
since
you've heard my voice.
There's the branding. I like the quick setup of a story like this. I like being dropped right to the middle of the action. I don't need to know all the details. And I love the attitude on board. Like, they are so over this.
Yeah, it gives you a glimpse into how long this has been happening.
Yeah.
Just through their reaction. And I'm with you. I love movies and television shows that begin this way. You're just dropped into a situation, and you as a viewer, you have to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not just spoon-fed to you. That was really cool.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was unusual about this cold open was, like, you know, there's a very Star Trekian quality of, like, early season Star Trek The Next Generation did this a lot. The long push in on Commander Riker as his eyes open up wide and the music swells and then we're in a commercial.
Right.
Or the theme song.
Right.
This fade out after Make Yourself at Home, you don't get the benefit of the music. It feels like a moment where the show didn't have the theme break written into the script and it was like shot for the edit later.
Yeah, it's interesting to pick those apart in Voyager especially, because I feel like with Voyager, they're so conscious about ramp up the action, ramp up the action, ramp up the action. And every act break has to have that mini cliffhanger to get you through to the end. And when something like this happens, it's really obvious. You just go like, Well, it's dramatic, but was that really the right place?
Star Trek has such a great grasp on structure that you're right. Like, any kind of deviation from that feels almost like a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. When we get a really good glimpse of the D'Vorah makeup, and look, we make fun of the makeup, sure. Like, sometimes you feel like they cut the budget, but there's Mike Westmore just, like, cranking away week after week. Gotta come up with a new alien. You can't hide the D'Vorah too much. I think it would be a mistake to make them look like, you know, Cardassians or something and just completely cover their faces. This makeup was really interesting, that little ridge over the eyebrow. And every now and then, Mark Haralick as Kashyyyk, his eyes, he looked like he had anime eyes. It looked like there was a filter in Instagram making his eyes gigantic under that makeup. It was kind of cool, but also
funny. He should get calls to be on Sailor Moon instead of so many Judas
exactly
parts, right?
That'll be his next calling, yeah.
I think there's an important quality to that choice, though, which is that you need to make Kashyyyk plausibly a romantic interest for Janeway, which means you need to have him be very, very good looking.
Yeah.
You can't overloaf him with the prosthetic at all. And in this way, he is very charismatic physically.
By the way, I'm going to petition that overloaf become a word in the OED or Webster's, whoever's got it. They need to do that.
On our show, we call all the facial prosthetics loaf.
Okay.
Short for meatloaf, because often, you know those episodes,
John. Oh, yeah.
It can get pretty rough.
But no, you're right, and that is the rule in Star Trek at this point anyway, which is you always have to see the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, they played that to great effect. Something you don't hear, and you just mentioned it at the end of the teaser, that push in and kind of where we're left with it. But we're left there and in multiple places with in-universe music. And I love that because it's something you never get on Star Trek. So it was cool to have it throughout this episode.
Don't you think Mahler gets ruined for the crew in a way that, like, the single of the moment that you hear on the radio all the time?
Yeah.
Eventually you just can't listen to it anymore?
Precisely.
Like, there are a lot of reasons why, like, contextually Mahler is going to be ruined for them because it's associated with being boarded all the time.
Right.
But, like, I got to think all Austrian German composers probably not on anyone's playlist anymore
right.
on this voyage.
Good point.
What did you think of these D'Vor ships? I thought, like, you only ever see them from behind, but they really look like gray Dideridex Romulan ships, really swoopy and curvy.
Kind of had that, like, a matter ray feel to them, quasi-organic, and they were cool. They were huge, like you needed that scale against Voyager.
Yeah.
Thought they were very sharp.
Yeah. I know we're going to talk a lot about this throughout the rest of the episode, but, like, the idea of our main baddie being, like, a slick-talking intellectual in jackboots, like, this is the fantasy fascist that modern fascists style themselves as or believe to be true. Like, the idea of a racist intellectual is, like, the height of science fiction, right?
Right. Yeah. But we play with that trope a lot in Voyager. Well, I mean, in Star Trek, but in Voyager specifically. And I kept thinking, like, okay, well, this is a good however many 15 years before, like, you know, Christoph Waltz and Inglourious mm-hmm. Bastards, mm-hmm. you know, playing that type to a T. I have some questions about the plan here because I feel like the transporter, I'm going to talk about the transporter later too, but, like, cellular mm-hmm. degradation, the fact that that would be a thing at all, even a little, just takes that right out as a good plan for anything, for anybody, because, you know, our crews are jumping in and out of that thing all the time, you know?
Well, I mean, doctors tell us now, like, they used to tell us that an occasional social drink or whatever is fine or maybe even healthful.
Yeah.
Now they're like, any amount.
Yeah, there's like, no.
Is no good.
No, not.
If any amount of transporting is bad at this moment, you got to believe that this is going to have some consequences going forward. As far as I know, not mentioned again.
Yeah. Right, of course, like the warp speed limit. Just don't mention it again. Like you, probably, I cannot hear Kashyyyk without thinking about the Wookiee homeworld. That's just immediately what popped into my head. Surely Brannon or Joe Manosky or somebody else, big fans of the Star Wars Holiday Special. And they're like, yeah, give that guy that name.
I got to drag us back to this transporter.
Oh, please. John. Please.
Like, I thought it was hilarious that Tuvok was one of the people stored in the buffer, because you got to believe that of anyone on the crew who would be a little apprehensive about being involved with the transporter at all,
right?
Let alone for the amount of time he's meant to be put in there and with so many people, like, he's got to think that there's a non-zero chance of being Tuvixed again, right?
He could. It'd be...
Like, he would never tell you. He would never, like, present stress in that way as a Vulcan.
Yeah.
But, you know, deep down.
Yeah.
Like, deep, deep down, he doesn't want to go through that again.
Like, okay, it would be one thing if he merges with Vorik because it's just another Vulcan. Mm-hmm. But, like, if he merges with that, you know, that kid who kept, like, calling out Neelix on the story. That'd be the worst.
How long would
Tuvok.
It take Vorik and Tuvok to recognize that they had been conjoined in the transporter?
Maybe not.
Probably a couple of days, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It might just be just a little intellectual battle that slowly emerges itself, you know? Some really good dialogue in this episode. I love the little exchange about the armed guards where Janeway says to Kashyyyk, consider them a reminder that Voyager is my ship. His reply, I don't think anyone could doubt that. Is pitch perfect. Love that.
Kashyyyk with his henches, I think, throughout the episode is a really interesting tension in every scene.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not even dialogue-driven. It's just their physical presence in a scene communicates a lot.
Yeah, yeah. They're well-matched, and they both have – they have presence, like you just said. They just have presence, you know. I like Torat. I like that we get this little, like, side character here for a moment. Something really funny about his prosthetic, I'm sure that you saw that he kind of inflates the nose. And I wondered if that was just sort of a thing that the actor discovered. Like, oh, if I'm wearing this and if I exhale sharply, that's going to make this thing inflate. I'm going to do that now. It's kind of like the apes in Planet of the Apes. If they inhaled too sharply, the whole mask would collapse. You know,
I'm ready to believe that.
Yeah.
I wish I could do that to myself every time I get my once a year sinus infection.
Yeah, there you go.
Just blow that thing out.
Yeah, you should do that. And I love that scene with Kashyyyk and Janeway playing good cop, bad cop, whether they had planned that in advance to interrogating Torat or not. It works well in the scene. It also works to inform how these two characters are now meeting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the dialogue to this episode because a couple of things really stuck out.
Mm-hmm.
The Niles Crane impression that Kashyyyk seems to be doing in every scene with his dialogue.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't mean that as pejorative. Like, Niles Crane as a character is a very specific and interesting thing that I think is a unique property in television. But, like, the tone and the cadence and the word choice, if you close your eyes and you listen to Kashyyyk talk, and then you play an episode of Frasier, like where Niles is talking about how much cinnamon to put on top of his latte or something. I think it's right there. I think they're very similar.
Well, he's got a voice. Like, he picked a voice to inhabit this character. And yeah. I love that because I had to look up, obviously, for the trivia anyway, but I was so curious about this guy, about Mark Haralick, and to see that he's from Texas. And I went, okay, there's nobody that I know from Texas who sounds like that. So he clearly is constructing a voice for Kashyyyk. And it's just the right level of, like, obnoxious, but intellectual, but also powerful, but smug. It's got it all.
What came first, Mark Haralick's Judas or Niles Crane?
There we go.
Because it might suggest that Niles Crane is the Judas of Frasier.
I think it does.
Wouldn't you say?
I think it does. That when we start the rewatch of Frasier, that you just keep that in the back of your head.
There's so little Neelix in this episode, and I just wish that there was a moment where he popped in to call them divorce ships.
If only.
I think that'd be fun. There's a scene in this episode where Kashyyyk has the deep V on the tunic. This is the moment where he's in the mess hall with Janeway.
Oh, yeah.
And he must feel right at home on a carpeted starship with the carpet he's rocking on his chest. He's like a walking acoustical tile.
Yes.
He's probably great for sound.
It's beautiful.
There was something about Torat that sounded very familiar to me in the same way that Kashyyyk sounded like Niles Crane.
Yeah.
Like, Torat sounded like Richard Dreyfuss to me. And when I looked into it, it was revealed that this is Richard Dreyfuss's brother.
I could not believe that. I looked him up as well, and right there in IMDb trivia, they said that Chevy Chase says this in the commentary for Vacation. That, oh, I was like, oh, yeah.
I knew I should have listened to that commentary track.
I know. But he's like, oh, yeah, Randolph Dreyfuss. That's Richard Dreyfuss's brother. Holy. And it's an interesting choice. Like, if you come from that family background, that you just stop using that as your name and you go as somebody else now. Why not play up the Richard Dreyfuss connection?
I mean, I'm sure he had a variety of reasons. It seems like a family in some conflict.
Right. Possibly so. By the way, I just did an episode of somebody's podcast, Films and Filth, and we talked about the epic early 80s German war film Das Boot. And this idea, this gambit of Voyager drifting through the sensor array, not unlike the failed plan in Das Boot to drift through the sensor net at the Strait of Gibraltar. So
I know. Such a great reference. Such a great movie.
I know it was on their mind when they wrote this. They're like, oh, yeah, you know what? Yeah. I just watched Das Boot. And then, hey, did you notice this? Kashuk calls our captain Catherine. And I think the last person who did that was Chakotay. And we'll see how that played out. Yeah.
But and he was iced out forever after that.
I was going to say, and speaking of Chakotay, that kiss.
We got to talk about this kiss.
That is way more than Chakotay ever got. And I think this is going to come back as a point of discussion.
When you go in with two hands.
Yeah.
That is so meaningful. Very few people have a two-handed kiss.
Yeah.
And for Janeway to do it, of all people, suggests an amount of passion that you just don't ever see from her.
Yeah. Yeah. That was serious stuff. Yeah.
Really seems like she's turned on here. Like she's, and I think the scene is important too, because the viewer has to believe that she has fallen for him.
Bingo.
And what are the other things on the list that could possibly convey that to a viewer? Like, this is so unique. What she's doing here is so unusual.
Yeah.
That I couldn't help but go along with it. I couldn't help but believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I do love the change back, though, the reveal, getting evil Kashuk back. And I love Kate's performance with him.
Can you be honest with me?
Yeah, yeah.
At this point in the episode,
I'm always like, honest.
Like, the moment that they kiss and he leaves, you believed him, right? Or were you always suspicious?
Honestly, I was always suspicious. And I will come back to that in our closing. I don't want to spoil it as to what fooled me or what didn't.
Okay.
But yeah. Yeah, I was onto it. But here's the thing. I was onto it in this fun way where I thought, like, wow, they are both playing to the absolute height of where this will take them. That kiss is just, that's the perfect example of it, you know?
Yeah.
But when we do get the reveal, when we get evil Kashuk back, I think Kate Mulgrew's moment there, instead of doing the obvious choice, the wide-eyed shock, oh no, you fooled me, how dare you, the subtle change, that little look on her face conveying the disappointment, I thought was fantastic. And again, talk about cracking dialogue. He says, you created false readings. And she says, isn't that the theme of the evening?
I think I
love it so much. I want to use that in my romantic life from now on. There's so many moments where it's appropriate.
I want more two-handed kisses in my romantic life.
Right. Well, good luck to you. Yeah.
How great is Kate Mulgrew in this episode at physical acting? Because as soon as this moment happens in the episode, her posture changes.
Yeah.
When she sits on the bridge next to this guy sitting in her chair,
she's
kind of slouched
next
to him in a way that you don't often see. She's underlit in this part of the bridge.
Right.
I think there's a lot going on here visually that tells the story happening inside her.
Yeah, 100%. One thing that we will never see on Voyager, but I really am concerned about and would love for somebody to explain, I want to see the shuttle manufacturing plant on Voyager. It's got to be huge, and it has to be working 24 hours a day. Like, there's 140 crew people on board Voyager. Easily 120 of them are in that plant at any given time.
You sometimes have to turn off the power to the Harry Kim woodwind factory in order to, like, divert more power into the shuttle facility.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's important.
Yeah.
Why do you think Janeway restrains herself from blowing up the ship after the double cross is revealed here? She so often goes right into this as like a first course of action when she's wronged. I think Voyager has so many moments like this. I was really surprised at her restraint.
Yeah. She wakes up in the morning in a bad mood and she's ready to blow up the ship. So,
I love that about her.
Yeah, but maybe this is one of those cases where Kashuk knows her so well. He's read the logs. He's read about Starfleet. Maybe that would have been a step too far. Maybe that would have overplayed her hand.
As a construction, I really enjoyed this episode because of how it resembled a sort of Ocean's 11 plot. Like, I love Janeway acting like she's being Ocean's Ocean's Elevened by Kashyyyk, but it's actually her doing the elevening.
Yes.
At Kashyyyk. And that's what makes the Ocean's 11 movie so much fun. Like, you get a presentation of the big plan or the caper, and then you watch it happen, but you're not seeing some very crucial aspects to it until they're revealed at the end in a moment that is so satisfying. And that is the sort of satisfaction I felt at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
When it's finally revealed that she won.
It makes for some very smart writing where you don't need those things handed to you. You just infer, aha, this is what was happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, I really, really like that part a lot.
I always find it relaxing, in times of great stress, to listen to music that's already in the public domain.
We'll get right back to Counterpoint after a word from this week's sponsor, ExpressVPN.
Hey, I've got a scenario, a little metaphor here that might sound familiar to you. You might have heard us say it here on the show one time before, but going online without ExpressVPN is like leaving your laptop unattended at the coffee shop while you run into the bathroom. Now, most of the time, you might be fine, but what if one day you come out of the bathroom and your laptop is gone? I will tell you, there was one time in my life when it was kind of empty, and I just thought, you know what? I don't want to pack all of this up while I just go in for a moment and come back out. But no, that would have been crazy for me to do that.
You know, I actually would have taken a laptop with me just to get the funny looks out of it.
Fair enough. Now, everybody needs a VPN. So think of it this way, Earl, and all of you listening. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network, whether it's in a cafe or a hotel or an airport, I mean, wherever is not home for you, your online data is simply not secure. Any hacker on the same network can gain access and steal your personal data, whether that be passwords or bank logins, credit card details, if you're buying something, you name it.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a huge amount of technical knowledge to hack someone. Look, there are walkthroughs out there to show people how to do this. A kid could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like the sound of that at all. And here's the thing, that kid, that hypothetical kid, they could get, say, upwards of $1,000 per person just by selling personal information on the dark web. And ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet.
Yeah, so here's the thing. The reason people steal is because they think they can do it easily. It's a low-effort thing for them. But the encryption on ExpressVPN is so secure that even a hacker with a supercomputer would need over 1 billion years to crack that encryption. And, you know, I'm going to say most people who are looking for an easy score don't have that kind of time.
I know I don't have that kind of time. So, yeah, no, and I expect somebody trying to make $1,000 doesn't have that kind of time. It doesn't work out per hour.
Yeah, but what does work is you can just fire up the app, click one button, boom, you're protected. ExpressVPN is working for you. Works on all your devices, tablets, phones, laptops, you name it. Install the app on everything you use, everything you take with you, and you have security on the go.
And it's not just us saying it. ExpressVPN is rated number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. But you know what? If you are just listening to me say it, I'll say it again that I use ExpressVPN. And I'll give you all a little tip. Here's a little hint on how I use it. Now, there are certain apps, particularly with sensitive data like travel information, bank information, anything financially related, that I know that I want to launch ExpressVPN with that. And it's so simple just by using one button. I made it even simpler. I created an automation on my phone so that when those apps launch, it automatically loads ExpressVPN. And when I close the app, it automatically closes ExpressVPN. That simple. So I know that I want to keep my information secure and secret and protected from hackers or any bad actors out there. And I know that I travel a lot, particularly with summer coming up. I've got a lot on my plate. I want to make sure that no matter where I go, my data is secure. And that's why I use ExpressVPN.
Absolutely. And you too can secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/missionlog. That's expressvpn.com/missionlog, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/missionlog.
All right, Adam, so as we roll into our discussion here, there were so many places in the last segment where we said, like, ooh, want to come back to that point, want to come back to that heavy topical, or maybe not so much, maybe just a technical thing we want to explore a little bit. I feel like with Star Trek as a whole, certainly with Voyager, sometimes you get, you know, the meaty, philosophical, ethical quandary episodes, and sometimes you just get space drama, soap opera, sometimes you get tech, whatever. I feel like this one is, you mentioned it perfectly. You said Ocean's 11. I feel like it's part of that. It's also partly like a war movie. You know, it's like outsmart the prison guards, sniff
like
out.
Like Das Ocean's 11?
Yes. There you go. You know, sniff out the bad guy. You think three steps ahead. And But you also color it with a little bit of soap opera in there, too, by introducing the romantic subplot. Let's talk about that aspect for a moment, the romantic subplot. You and I were both kind of discussing the moment, the kiss. Janeway's either completely absorbed dedication to this mission or her true feelings for somebody who got under her skin. What's going on?
I really think this episode is an achievement in casting, right? Because I think Kate Mulgrew's greatness could work with a lot of people. I won't say anyone.
Sure.
But I think casting Kashyyyk was such an important part in determining how good this episode could possibly be, because I think this is the moment in the episode. This is its crescendo. Like, this is the apex of it. Because if you don't believe this scene, it betrays everything that the episode's writers are trying to create in terms of the mystery.
Right.
Like, it's such a clockwork, the way these two opposing plans are working, that if there's even a moment that you don't believe that they're into each other here, I think you're very smart. You saw through Kashyyyk's plan all along. Someone like me, who's a little slower, you may be willing to ride for Kashyyyk a little longer than this scene. And I think this is the moment that's so important to nail. And I really love how long we linger with Janeway here after Kashyyyk leaves, because it's not just a kiss to say goodbye. It's the moment where she's got to sit in it and consider it. And that is the moment that sells it even more. Because if we just cut away after the kiss,
yeah,
maybe Janeway kisses a bunch of guys, hollow or ordinary.
Right.
And maybe that's just how it is. But to watch her consider what has happened, it makes you believe that the feelings are true. And that's so important here in preserving the mystery.
So, okay, like I appreciate your kind flattery, although I will disagree with you that maybe I had outsmarted it. I don't think that's the case necessarily. I think what was wrong with my watching of that scene or of these moments is that in the back of my head, I kept doing what we call on Mission Log, playing the home game. I kept playing the home version of this where it was like, oh, okay, a TV show in the late 90s where you've got a good guy and a bad guy, and we've only got five acts to tell this story. Where are we going to get? And if he's really not trustable, then that means that Janeway has to be two or three steps ahead of him. So what is she doing in order to be two or three? And that's unfortunate, because watching it that way, I think, takes away just from kind of the emotional joy of, wow, they really sold it, which they did. And then that's why I kind of come back, even watching it through my lens of thinking, all right, he's lying to her, she's lying to him. At the end of the day, she's got to win. because she's our captain, she's our hero on our ship, right? Even if that has to happen, what is the deal with the level of passion that's going on here? Is it just she is that good? Or is there truly some feeling there? Is it one of those things where in another world, under other circumstances, she could have fallen for this guy, given that he's not a jackbooted fascist thug? Again, a different world, a different universe.
I'm really glad you gave me that definition of home game, because to me, that's always been not using a public restroom and holding it until you get home.
Sure. Yes. which is fair, which you should do, because other places are dirty. So,
did you believe her at the end when she told Kashyyyk, even now, if you were to truly defect, she'd take him with them?
Well, do you read that line as even now, if you choose to stay, or even at this point, if you hadn't double-crossed us? Because I thought the same thing, and I thought that with both reads of that line. And you know what? I think both ways, yes, I believe her, because at the end of the day, I think what's important here is that Janeway has integrity. And even though he points out very clearly how she breaks the rules, she will violate the Prime Directive like nobody's business. At the end of the day, she does those things based on an internal sense of morality and the integrity that comes along with the job. So that if he walked out the door but then walked right back in and said, no, you know what? You're right, and Voyager's great, and they'll probably kill me when I get back on my ship. Okay, you're coming with us.
Do you think that this moment represents the last time Captain Janeway allowed herself to fall for a corporeal person? Because, after this, it gets all Fairhaven-y and stuff. And Chakotay, I don't think, ever gets another at-bat. But, do you think this is it for her? Do you think Kashyyyk... The reason I ask that is because I think it goes back to the whole how much of this feels real to Janeway, how much of herself is in this plan and her true feelings.
Right.
Could she really have seen a life with this guy? Was there just a small part of her that was actually excited by him, was attracted to him in all of these ways? I mean, there are a lot of traits, compatible traits, that they have. The fascism, not so much, but the music and the other ways that they see the world. Her interest in chest hair and great haircuts. He checks those boxes.
He does. Yeah.
You think Chakotay's holding his breath really hard, trying to make more chest hair for himself?
There needed to be more Chakotay in this. There really did. He's the only other one who can call her Catherine and get away with it. I feel like, this is one of the only times that we've let Janeway let her hair down a little bit and have some kind of deep feelings for somebody. We haven't played with this a lot at all since, go back to Resolutions when she had her fling with Chakotay. So I feel like it's one of those where, she can only have a life of duty so much. She's got to get to a point where the person underneath the rank actually comes out and gets to have an emotional life of her own. It's unfortunate that it's with a, fascist thug. But for all the reasons that you pointed out, there might be reasons that they are parallel.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears here a little bit because I do think that is the most fascinating thing about this. How much of Janeway's inner emotional life do we get to explore here, and how much is real and how much is it good acting? And I don't mean good acting on Kate Mulgrew's part, but good acting on Catherine Janeway's part.
Exactly.
That's a whole other fascinating question. But I do want to switch gears here just a little bit. And first of all, just on a technicality, right or wrong to chalk up some additional problem to the transporters? Because honestly, at the end, by the end of the episode, like, it's a funny gambit to throw the vegetables in the cargo containers, but nobody is actually endangered by being stored in the transporter buffer. That's just a thing they invent and say, oh, it's really dangerous, can't stand too many more of these inspections. By the last inspection, they're on a shuttle anyway, and they're getting out of there. The reason I bring
in the Jenga construction of this story, you can take that block out,
yeah,
and the tower still stands.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you need it.
Yeah, nothing fails there. And I wondered, because Star Trek has had so many examples of people getting stuck in the transporter buffer. I mean, look, it split Riker. It gave us Scotty 80 years after he disappeared. You know, none of this should be anything new about a transporter. At all.
Anytime you can give us a close-up shot of a future vegetable, let alone a barrel full of them,
yeah,
you got to give me that shot.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
A barrel full of future vegetables, I didn't know what that long, skinny thing was. I feel like we were missing some dragon fruit and Buddha hands. They always go back to those on Voyager. There was kind of an annoying thing where Janeway comes in and she does this thing. It's like Kirk in Star Trek the Motion Picture. They're beaming up Sonak and I forget the other name. The transporter's not working. He pushes Rand away, starts playing with the controls. They die, and he looks at Rand and goes, there's nothing you could have done. You did it, first of all. You're the one who did it. Okay, but what happens here? Janeway runs into the cargo bay. She grabs the tricorder, and then she gives some useless command, like, give it more power, which is what works anyway. You know, it is.
Why aren't you always using the most power in a moment like that?
Yeah, right. Like,
that's what I would prefer.
That's a very good time. Like, if you're reassembling my atoms, please use all the available power to do so.
I would prefer my atoms to be reassembled in the least efficient or economical way possible. Throw all your resources at that.
You know, the people who pay for the cheap transporter plan, they're like on the, you know, like,
they
that third
tier. They know the choice they made.
Yeah, like the third tier cellular plan where your connection's not that good. It's like those are the people in the future who get the cheap transporter plan. And I want to come back a little bit to something you brought up before about our space fascists, our space Nazis. I don't know if I say that we automatically get flagged by, you know, some algorithm listening to the content of our podcast, but it is interesting. We've had races or species, I should say, that represent various strains of fascism, and sometimes very specifically Nazis, like what's lifted out of World War II history to inform what Cardassians do. The Herogian were all over it, and they're like, yeah, not only do we like this, we're going to change half of Voyager into a holodeck simulation of this and just have a ball here. I wonder, first of all, do you feel like it's just the writers who are influenced because of the generation that they grew up in? I mean, you're talking about these are the most important stories to come out of the middle of the last century. Here are writers writing this stuff in the 80s and 90s, and these are the biggest stories that they've ever heard and are going to tell themselves. I wonder if that's part of the influence here. And I also wonder if, you know, you phrased it in this very interesting way to say that there's this bizarre intellectual fascist trope that doesn't really hold water. Like, it doesn't really fit. So is it purely invention? Is it a bit of fantasy? Is it heightening our mustache-twirling villains? What do you make of what we have here?
Well, I think the first question you asked, like, I am reluctant to speak for a writer and their reasons for making a story like this. It does seem generally that across movies and television, this is the most common antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's just a lot of shades of this that you can use in all kinds of stories. Like you could have the dopey Nazi just as often as you could have the sadistic Nazi, just as much as you could have the quote-unquote intellectual Nazi.
Yeah.
And yet you don't have to know a lot about world history to get what their deal is and get the evil. I think it's a shorthand, and it's a useful shorthand.
Yeah.
To someone creating a story.
There's something interesting about Kashik here that clearly he's the alpha. Clearly he is in command of all of these, you know, and presumed thousands of other inspectors who we don't see. That there's something scary about the idea who is that charming and that intelligent who is so ideologically driven. Because I think the frightening thing there is that you can come to all of these bad ideas through whatever circumstance, through indoctrination, through the culture that he's in, et cetera. But what makes it really scary then is the intellectualization of that and convincing oneself that those views are right and really having little recourse. Like, you feel like if anybody could change this guy's mind, then hopefully it's Catherine Janeway and the rock-solid ideals of the Federation. But even those are no match, because he has already done the mental gymnastics of convincing himself of his own position.
I mean, just because you've written a book and are a frequent guest on a news program, like, all of a sudden that's a shortcut to being called an intellectual.
Yeah.
But that isn't the case.
Right. Right.
That's just a thing that you do.
Yeah. And harassing telepaths, that's just a thing that he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
This guy Kashik, I think a unique and good construction.
Yeah.
On Voyager.
Agreed.
I think one thing I wanted to say was that this was really, what is that, a two-hander? A show that really just spotlights two characters. Like, this is the Kashik and Janeway show to the exclusion of everyone. And I often wonder when I watch a Star Trek episode just how much more meaty it could be if we got a two-parter out of this, if we got the involvement of a few more characters to stir it up. Because I can't tell you how many scenes I counted where it was 7 of 9, arms crossed in the cargo bay, watching go down. And I would really like to know more about what she thought of this experience. And I could say that about a lot of characters.
Chakotay.
On the show. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. What is he thinking?
I think the risk is that if you tell the audience too much of what's going on with Janeway outside of Kashik, then we start to put the pieces together. Because if she has an encounter with Chakotay and he's like, what are you doing? This guy's terrible and I don't trust him. And you might be able to get away with that a little bit early on. But at a certain point, we also have to know that Janeway is conferring with all these people to get them in on her plan. And they're being super...
There's a long tradition of Star Trek episodes where we don't know what the captain's thinking and the crew talks behind their back going like, I don't know what the deal is with the captain. Right. And all along, the captain knew the score.
Yeah.
And
this
is a version of that.
Yeah. I think one of those strengths is that, you know, look, when Voyager is great, it's great. And they've hit this stride in season 4, and here we are in early season 5. And a lot of that attention has been on 7 of 9, rightfully so, because this is a character that is just full of potential and possibility for storytelling. But along comes one like this, and you go like, oh, but wait a minute. Janeway is actually the star of the show. And this is the kind of thing where she really shines. And you mentioned it. You said it so well. When you have two characters who are just powerhouses like that, you know, one of my favorite all-time episodes of anything is Duet, because you've got these two incredibly strong actors portraying two incredibly strong characters, and all I need to do is be in the room with them and just see what happens. And they accurately capture that here, too.
It could be worse. Everyone could have had to listen to nonstop polka for hours on end.
All right, we have made it to the end of our discussion of Counterpoint, as we do here in the Mission Log tradition. I know this is totally new for you, so I'll just recap for you and others who are playing the home game, as we call it.
Not my home game.
No.
Actually, slightly... I can't speak to where people are listening to this show.
You don't know. They might be playing the home game of the home game as they're listening to this. So, yeah, it's important. We are going to wrap this up. We're going to assess if the episode holds up. And we're also going to see if there are some morals, meanings, and messages to be derived for us to think about until next time. So, Adam, as the new person here, I will just set this up and say that when we ask if an episode holds up, that is a purposely vague question, because you may love one aspect of this show, but it may fall apart for you for some very personal reason. But you tell me, by whatever criteria you've decided, does this episode hold up?
Well, as much as I enjoy appreciating media for like all of its technical aspects and all of the performances and all of everything else, I think the one criteria I really use to determine whether or not I enjoy a movie or a TV show is how it makes me feel.
There you go.
And
that's fair.
I think this episode holds up because there is a universality, a very human reaction to feeling like you've been double-crossed or betrayed. And we see two characters experience that this episode. We see our protagonist and antagonist go through that. So you get two bites of that same apple.
Yeah.
And I thought that made it hit especially hard for me as an experience, because those are some of the worst parts of life, is that realization. And to see two very skilled actors emote those feelings, I mean, those are familiar moments you're watching on screen. So yeah, absolutely. I think this episode holds up in that way, for sure.
As well as I know you, I did not know that you had a tragic love story in your past where you fell in love with a space fascist who tried to send away, you know, people under your care.
That's... Once they kiss you with two hands?
Yeah.
I mean, try not to fall for that, John. I dare you.
Yeah. No, I'm made of weaker stuff, so I know that I would. Yeah. Look, I agree. I mean, this episode, first and foremost, is just fun. Like, there is so much good scenery chewing. There's so much built in automatically to the cat and mouse game that's going on that it can't help but keep your attention. I did wonder certain things, and I think rightfully so. Like, would a lesser captain who is less skilled at acting be able to pull this off? Because...
Can you name some names?
Yeah, I don't think Ben Sisko could do this. I just don't. I think Kirk can, because I think Kirk can turn on the charm.
I think both of those captains have a very low ceiling for punching a dude in the face.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, yeah, that's true.
This is the way that Janeway is. Like, Janeway can keep it so under wraps. She's going to punch you in a different way, in a psychological way. You know,
I don't think Picard could do this.
Yeah.
You know?
I couldn't see that either.
Not with this level of passion. No.
No, I mean, Picard is so often the recipient of the betrayal.
Yep. Exactly. And I'm going to change my one note here, because as I told you, when I prepare my notes, I kind of do the first pass and I just write down whatever I'm thinking in the moment. And I thought that this would not hold up on the rewatch. Because the first time I watched it, I thought, he's lying. Now we're trying to get to the point where Janeway figures it out, and then we get led on what Janeway was doing the whole time. And I thought that was really the strength of the episode. But then I rewatched it a couple of more times, and I thought, nope, that's not the strength of the episode. The strength of the episode is the performances that these two actors bring and the emotional reality of all the scenes that they're in.
Yeah.
So even if you know what's happening, as we just did, we sat there and looked at all these moments and go, wow, that was a great moment. Wow, that was a great moment. Wow, they really sold it. And how many ways can we take the subtext and the inner lives of what's happening in these terrific moments? So I think you can watch it in a way and just enjoy the fun, enjoy the 3D chess of it all. But I think you can go back and watch it and think, oh, wow, but there's some adult emotional intelligence happening on screen here, too.
For sure.
And that brings us to the question about morals, meanings, messages. Did you, you know, sometimes we ask, was there a moment that telegraphed to you and the audience, you know, don't eat lead paint or save the whales or whatever, or maybe not. So what did you learn here?
I think when I really thought about it in totality, and I thought about everything Janeway did and the question of what happens on that, in that shuttle bay between them, she's clearly fighting evil. She's fighting evil the whole time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be completely joyless. You can have a little fun during.
Yeah.
This guy's a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
He's an awful monster person. But Janeway, she could get hers if she wanted to.
Yeah.
And, like, you can be creative when you're the captain. You can find moments to get a little hot and heavy with a character that is like the Canadian boyfriend that the girl makes up in high school, the one that gets talked about but never seen. Like, so few people ever see this guy and interact with him. That's another strange aspect of this episode. Like, he's constantly dismissing people from the rooms that they're in.
That's true.
Constantly in rooms together alone.
Yeah.
She could do whatever she wants with this guy. And she dabbles in some areas to make herself feel better. I don't have a problem with that at all. She's, you know, fighting Nazis is so often punching Nazis in the face. And you got to do that whenever you can.
Sure.
But you hurt your hand doing that sometimes. Kate Mulgrew's punching Nazis in the face with her lips. And I think it's okay if she enjoys the experience a little bit, taking one for herself, you know?
Yeah.
Taking advantage in the process. So that's what I feel like the message is. It's a little bit twisted.
No, we're oddly parallel in some way, because, you know, my lesson was outsmart space Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she does. She doesn't need to punch him in the face necessarily.
Yeah.
She needs to outsmart him. And like you just said, she's having a good time doing it. I mean, mm-hmm. outsmart space, that should be a given mm-hmm. regardless. I mean, that might be a little too short of a lesson, but I'm going to tie it back to the big picture here of Star Trek. And that is that we have an episode here that puts Star Trek's values on display. It's very simple. People need help. Help them. Fascists show up at your doorstep. Stop them. And when it's hard to do what's right, you do it anyway, and you try a little harder. And that trying a little harder isn't having the bigger gun, because, well, the D'Vor already have the bigger guns. You just need to be smarter in the process. And also, I would say about Janeway, you know, all of her interactions with Kashuk are so interesting, because he's trying to learn and he thinks that he's figured out a way to outsmart her, because he thinks that these Starfleet principles are the Achilles heel. But this episode shows us that selflessness is not a weakness. And in fact, it is quite the opposite. And to someone on the outside, like Kashuk, it may look that way, but Janeway follows the compassionate course while also thinking ahead. And I think that is a great thing to watch and a great thing to absorb. Adam, why don't you tell people again where they can find you?
I'm one of the two hosts of The Greatest Generation and Greatest Trek. Those are two Star Trek podcasts that people seem to really love. People love Mission Log too, John.
Every now and then.
We're available anywhere you can get podcasts. We're on the Maximum Fun Network, and we've been doing this for a long time. We're going to keep doing it until there's no more Star Trek to talk about. And then we'll probably go back to the beginning and start all over again, because that's how much fun we're having.
Okay, great. All right. We'll join you in that process. All right. Mission Log is produced by Roddenberry Entertainment. If you'd like to support us directly, you can do so at patreon.com/missionlog for early access to shows and the Mission Log Discord. Our website is missionlogpodcast.com. And for more Star Trek news and discussion, visit trekmovie.com.
Tune into the next Mission Log, where you'll discuss Latent Image.
Some of the music for Mission Log provided by Warp 11, online at warp11.com. Special thanks to consulting producers, Matt Esposito, Homer Frizzell, Julie Miller, Mike Richards, Mike Schaubel, Paul Shadwell, and David Takechi. Is Baxter even on the ship anymore? He could have bench-pressed these guys out of the airlock. End transmission.
This is a Roddenberry podcast. For more great podcasts, visit podcast.roddenberry.com.